As is your custom, might we just begin with a moment of reflection. God of all things created, all things which bless us, all things which present us with challenge, Lord God, the creator of all things, on this day we pause, and this would be our simple prayer. May we always avoid arrogance, mindful that what we say and what we think can become vehicles of your intention, your mind, your word for the age in which we live. In this we ask in the name of Christ. Amen. In 1939, my denomination, the Methodist Church, gathered in Kansas City, and we brought to a conclusion a structure, or we, I should say, we instituted a new structure based upon some issues that had grown out of the Civil War period. The Civil War period found Methodism broken into three bodies. There was the Methodist Church, the Methodist Episcopal Church, and then there was the Methodist Church South. And those three churches existed for almost 100 years, separated. In 1938, in Kansas City, those three groups came together, and listen to this. In the name of Jesus Christ, they unified. And what that meant was that these three distinct historical bodies said they were now one body in the unity of Christ. And when they structured that unified body, they used a geographical system to create what we call jurisdictions. And they serve simply as a basis of organization, election of bishops, etc. The way the United States was configured was pretty obvious. North and South, with East, Central, and West being the subdivisions, which meant we had six jurisdictions that were fundamentally geographical in orientation and function, save one. And that was called the Central Jurisdiction. It had nothing at all to do with geography. It had to do with race. In that the people that put together that unified moment in Christ saw fit to say that black Methodists needed to be encapsulated in a central jurisdiction that had nothing at all to do with geography, but was all about racism. That experience lasted until 1968. Think about that. And think about what was happening in the country and in the world during that period of time. You find Harry Truman desegregating the armed services. You find the question of civil rights relevant to education being adjudicated. You find the passage of the Civil Rights Act. Not to mention the beginnings of what we today call the Civil Rights Movement. I simply share that with you to suggest that over the lifespan of the church, and we use that term generically now, the question of race has haunted us. And what I'd like to do this morning is talk a little bit about the history of that haunt, and then look at a voice that is really a voice in process, the voice of the theologian James Kahn, now professor emeritus at Union Seminary in New York. By 1960 in America, the black church was beginning to feel an enormous sense of emergence. And because of that, they had begun to think about a black theology and what it was that a black theology meant. What is interesting about their understanding of a black theology has nothing at all to do in terms of figuring out, is God transcendent or immanent? It had nothing at all to do with worrying about whether or not the Bible is literally true or needs to be critically evaluated. The fundamental issue that emerged out of black theology is this: how can we believe in God in a racist culture? And more critically, how is it that our belief in God can address that culture? Now, there had been some people who had made some issues about that and tried to give it direction. For example, There was a man by the name of Washington, Joseph R. Washington. He was a clergyman and something of a theologian. His observation was this: Black community, forget about being a part of the church in North America. You know why? Because it's a negative participation. You're thought of as being less than. And I so remember, as I'm sure many of you do, that there was once upon a time something called the Week of Christian Unity. It usually happened in January. And what that meant was that there was an interchange between churches. And we went around and worshipped in various places. My memory of that is pretty clear. There were very few blacks who came to the white churches. And you can flip that story over and make the observation that in fact there were very, very few whites who went to the black churches. And so Joseph Washington said, let's stop trying to be the black church. It isn't working. It's perceived as being negative. And therefore his suggestion was, let's work at becoming integrated into the white church. It's not dissimilar from what we see, for example, in the world of economics in the Hill District of Pittsburgh in the 30s and 40s, in the early 50s, where black communities decided they were no longer going to be black and began to be assimilated into the white culture. Obviously, that did not go as well as Washington had thought it would. A second voice comes out of Detroit, Michigan. His name was Cleage. He was a black pastor, graduate of Wayne State, graduate of the Union Theological Seminary in New York City. And his notion was black nationalism. He learned that lesson primarily from Malcolm X. And for Cleage, the notion was that the church needed to be divided into various and separate sections, and that there needed to be a black church standing alongside of a white church, almost from the point of view of being called separate but equal. And so that is the background against which this morning we take a look at James Caan, who tried to address that conflict. What kind of a black church do we want? How is that black church integrated with or to with a white church? And what role does theology play in any of that? James Caan's inspiration came out of the Black Manifesto. And as you may remember, the Black Manifesto simply was the notion that no longer would blacks be quiet, but rather they would make demands, and they would seek representation, and they would in fact receive reparations for their treatment. The person who instigated that, of course, was James Forman, who in May of 1968 walked down the main aisle at the Riverside Church in New York and said, things have to change. And so we encounter James Caan. What's interesting about James Caan is this. He is a man who comes out of the black experience, lives in the white man's world, and then begins to forge a kind of synthesis. Let's look at something of his background. He was born in 1936 in Arkansas. The town in which he lived had 400 black individuals and 800 white individuals. And that town was broken into separate but equal institutions and categories. And so James Caan, growing up in that community, understood what it meant when someone talked about a lynching. James Caan understood what it meant when he was cautioned as a child never to drink out of the white fountain. And as James Caan came of age, he went off to college, received his BA there. Then he went on to Garrett Divinity School, where he did a bachelor's degree in divinity. Then he pursued a PhD at Northwestern, all of which were successful endeavors. And he eventually taught at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. In that process, this was his undergirding question. Why is it that good Christian whites are capable of treating black Christians so badly? And as he struggled with that issue, he developed a theology that is still in process, I might add. His central message initially was this: Christianity is all about liberation. And coming out of the background that he did and living in the era in which he found himself, he began a polemic that did a couple of things. First of all, it was prophetic in the sense of the word that he challenged the white church of his time. He challenged them around a couple of ideas. Number one, why are we not integrated? Number two, is the absence of integration by design? Number three, how do we change that? The second component of his theology was what I'm going to call contextual. Like Paul Tillich, James Kahn came to believe that you never do theology. And I know that's a technical term, but by doing theology, it simply means, how do you think about God and faith and all of that kind of stuff? How do you think about that? And his answer was, you think about it always contextually. It's kind of like what Tip O'Neill once said. All politics are local. And James Kahn came to the understanding that all theology has to be and always is local, particularly in the context of race. And so James Kahn began to define two terms. The first term was black power. Now, of course, we all know that Malcolm X had defined black power. And it basically looked like a nationalism that established a black community that was totally and completely divorced from the white community. In fact, was antithetical to it. That is not what James Kahn means when he talks about black power. Black power for James Kahn means to be emancipated as a black person from white oppression wherever you meet it. For him, black power was the ability as a human being to be free and to be liberated. He once wrote these words: black power is not about blacks doing whatever they want to do. Black power is the strength that allows you to become what you should be. And of course, that should be always, in his thinking, has to do with being a liberated person, free from the dominations of oppression. The second term that he defined was black theology. And this is where I'm asking you to be a little patient whenever I talk about what he means by this, because for him, it is an evolving process. Black theology basically said this: theology must always be contextual, and therefore black theology must always analyze the conditions in which black people find themselves through the prism of the Christian faith. For James Kahn, the crisis of race in America was indeed always a theological question. Now, he took a lot of heat on that because there were black leaders during the 60s and 70s, Malcolm X, Silky Carmichael, people of that kind, whose response was, burn it down. And beyond that, who said, Christianity has been a part of racism for as long as Christianity has lived. Therefore, it has nothing to say to the context in which we find ourselves. James Kahn disagreed with that. And he began the enterprise of developing a black theology that could be applied to the age in which he found himself. And what are some of the critical ingredients in that theology? Well, interestingly enough, he begins with the notion of sin. For James Caan, sin has to do with something called hubris or pride or arrogance. And for James Caan, sin has to do with acting out relationally that concept in the world. And therefore, he reached the conclusion that sin speaks to racism. He is one of the first theological voices to actually say that racism was an expression of sin. For him, that sin was expressed personally and communally. What does that mean? It means that any time a person used the N-word in a relationship or about a relationship, that was a personal expression that he called sin. It wasn't something that was politically incorrect. It wasn't something that came out of a social mores issue. Not at all. It was an expression of hubris on the part of a person. Number two, he believed that sin, in terms of racism, was practiced and supported corporately. And of course, most of us understand exactly what that means. Hiring processes, real estate issues, the redlining of properties. James Caan said that any time you find racism being operative in a corporate sense, that must be called out as sin. The second thing that he talks about in his theology has to do with God. And this is where I think James Caan gets into a little bit of, not trouble, but misunderstanding. He talks about the fact that in his mind, God is black. Now what he means by that is this, that God understands oppression. That God has lived with the reality of suppression. And that God seems to be a God who is constantly interested in liberation. And of course, for James Caan, probably the two most significant expressions of that notion of God, the first is found in the Old Testament. You know, if you read that Old Testament carefully, you soon discover that one of the main themes and concerns of God was, let my people go. And if you don't let them go, you're going to pay a big price. So as you look at the book of Exodus primarily, what you see there is an understanding of how it is that someone could reach the notion that the mind of God is about blackness, given the context and the prism that a man like James Caan looks through as he tries to understand the relationship between the church and Christian faith and the context in which he finds himself. And so it was that God was thought of as being black. Now the second basis upon which he concludes that that idea is Jesus. And if you think about the life of Jesus, of course we all bring countless understandings to that. But as a man like James Caan, coming out of the experience that was his, not mine, his, he came to think that Jesus also was black. In that Jesus seems to be somebody who was always interested in creating moments of liberation. He liberated people from the heavy burden of legalism. Jesus. What are the law and the prophets? Jesus says, love God. Your neighbor is yourself. And when you put those two sentences alongside of the history of Judaism relevant to legalisms, it's pretty light. Jesus was interested in liberating women. He was interested in liberating lepers. He was interested in liberating tax collectors, and on the list goes. And James Caan reaches the conclusion that that constitutes Jesus as being black. Coming off of that, of course, he had to define what that meant. And James Caan said what it ultimately meant had nothing at all to do with skin color. I mean, obviously, how do we know if God has skin, first of all? And if we're able to determine that, how do we know what color it is? Anytime I think about this idea, I always think about the old black woman who faced a very serious heart issue. And the physician suggested she see a heart surgeon, and he suggested immediate surgery. And so they put the old woman on the table and anesthetize her, and they open her chest, and they're fooling around with her heart. And all of a sudden, her heart stops. And they start all the medical procedures, stimulation, etc. And they're watching the clock. 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4, 7, 8, 9 minutes, and finally it clicks back on. She survives the surgery and is in recuperation. The young physician who saved her life comes into her room, and he said, "How are you?" "Fine," she said. "I'm doing very well." He said, "You know what? While we were operating on you, you were actually dead." "Oh," she said, "I know I was." "Well," he said, "tell me, while you were dead, did you by chance see God?" "Oh, yeah," she said, "I saw God." "Well," he said, "tell me, what did he look like?" And the old black woman said, "She was black." So, what James Caan is saying here has nothing to do with that kind of stupidity. It has to do with a mindset, and it has to do with soul. And it has to do with what he ultimately began to call an attitude. For James Caan to say that God is black means that the mind of God wants to set the world free. To say that God is black is to say that God opposes oppression. To say that God is black suggests a source of hope and promise that is consistently in the world. It is what Saint John, it is what the Gospel of John says when it talks about the light shining in the darkness. And the darkness has not overcome it. When James Caan talks about God being black, that is clearly what he means. Now let's think a little bit. We talked a little bit about sin. We talked a little bit about God. What about the whole notion of how we implement that in our time? He begins to talk about that question by saying that white Christians need to become black. Quite obviously, that has nothing to do with pigmentation. What it has to do with a kind of empathy. And he makes a distinction between empathy and sympathy. Sympathy, he says, "Oh, I'm so sorry for your situation." Maybe even means that. Maybe even wants to change it. While empathy means you are one with a person's circumstance. About 3 years ago, there was a marvelous book released on the life of Mother Teresa. It was written by a young Jesuit who had been sort of her confidant, her confessor, and who became her biographer. In that book, there are two cardinal ideas that really upset a lot of people. Here was the first one. Mother Teresa, on her way to Calcutta to her first assignment, spoke with Jesus. And this was the nature of the conversation. "Jesus, if you go with me and are my constant companion, I'll go anywhere." The book records how it was that 20 years into having been working in Calcutta, Mother Teresa confessed to this young man that there were times in her life when she wondered where Jesus was. The second point that he makes in the book is this. Having arrived in Calcutta, Mother Teresa was assigned to a convent. And every morning early, she arose, readied herself, had a nice breakfast, and went down to where all these poor people lived and ministered to them. And at the end of the day, she would return to the convent, bathe, have a very nice warm meal, sleep in a very nice clean bed, and get up and start all over again. And after a while of doing that, Mother Teresa came to this understanding. I cannot minister to these people until I am one with them. And so that is when she decided she would leave the convent and she would live in the ghettos, sleeping on a bench which served as also her desk and her table, using ashes to scrub her teeth, eating what was left and could be found. She became one with the people that she sought to serve, and she made the case that that could be the only basis. I was privileged, I think, to have gone to divinity school during an era whenever some of the greatest minds in the church were teaching. And there was one man who taught pastoral care. His name was David Graybill. And David Graybill made a lot of good points, but he made this one. You cannot be a good pastor until you walk in the shoes of the person to whom you are ministering. I learned that in a very practical way during my mother's illness with cancer that ultimately took her. Mother was a very faithful woman in very many ways. And as the disease progressed, one afternoon as I stopped to spend some time with her, I found her to be inordinately down. And as we talked, she said, you know, I'm really distressed. My minister was here today. Why would you be distressed, Mom? Well, she said, he said something to me that has bothered me. Well, what was that? He told me that if I just prayed hard enough, I would be healed. You see how important it is to walk in somebody's shoes? Before you offer some insight or some suggestion or some correction, maybe we should walk in people's shoes. And that's what he's saying about white Christians. You implement the gospel in our time by becoming black. James Caan began to expand his understanding of black power and black theology. And he did that by embracing, ironically, a couple of very, very white German concepts. Here's the first one. He built his ministry, his teaching, solidly on the primacy of the Bible. James Caan was a man whose understanding of the Scriptures was always contemporary. And what that means is, what does this say today? Have you ever... Well, let me put it this way. Every now and then, you know, you sit through a sermon and you wonder, what does all of that business about the Amorites and the Philistines and the Jebusites and 5,000 years of this and 2,000 years of this and five kings after that and two after that and six after that, what does that all have to do with me? So for James Kahn, the primacy of the Bible had to do with building a linkage between what we find in the Bible and where people are living. And he was indebted to Karl Barth, the great German theologian of the last century, for understanding that. Because, you know, Barth said, it's not about the words in the Bible. It's about the Word in the Bible. And so as James Kahn tried to give to his community, the black community, and beyond that, the wider community known as the church, as he sought to give them a sense of purpose and a soul and an attitude, for him he found the Bible to be inordinately helpful in that the word in the Bible is freedom. The word in the Bible is emancipation. The word in the Bible is liberation. And it is quite true that you can use those terms to apply it to any number of circumstances. But in James Kahn's world of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, it desperately had to be applied to race. Secondly, for him, theology is always Christo-centered. People make the mistake of referring to James Kahn as a black theologian. That's true. But it's more true to say that James Kahn is a Christo-centered theologian. And of course, what that meant for him was that the real power and the real meaning of Jesus is liberation. And it is liberation now. This gets into the whole concept of God's kingdom, doesn't it? Jesus said some very bizarre things about the kingdom of God. The kingdom is at hand. I tell you, there are those of you who will not sleep before you see the kingdom come. Think about those words in the context of that first generation of Christians who began to see their leadership in the context of men like Peter and others be crucified. Think about what that must have meant as they lived out in that first century, the oppression of Rome. And that drives us to ask the question, what did Jesus mean when he talked about the kingdom? He talked about according to James Kahn, he talked about the liberation of the human spirit. And he writes, and if that meant, what did that mean to you as a leper? Well, I don't know if you're familiar with this or not, but leprosy in the old world was much more of a social disease than it was a skin disorder. Lepers were thought to be people who had earned and deserved that kind of illness. And so as they walked through the streets of Jerusalem and other cities of ancient Palestine, what did they have to do? They had to ring a bell. And they had to cry out, leper, leper, leper. And James Kahn suggests that Jesus came to emancipate the leper. So the centrality of Jesus in his thinking is clear. Jesus, the real Jesus, is all about liberation. Thirdly, he takes the notion that truth, is never propositional. And what he means by that is, to sit around talking about truth might be academically satisfying. To have endless seminars on truth might be helpful. But James Kahn writes that ultimately the reality of truth survives in what he calls encounter. And James Kahn was indebted to the people who marched in the early days of the civil rights movement. Because those people took the truth of racial freedom And they encountered police dogs, and they encountered fire hoses, and they encountered imprisonment, and they encountered beatings, and they encountered lynchings. And interestingly enough, James Caan writes that he is indebted to Dietrich Bonhoeffer concerning this understanding of racial truth. Because you may remember that Dietrich Bonhoeffer tried everything to deal with Nazis and Hitler. He tried reasonableness. He tried dialogue. He tried the underground seminary. He tried the underground church. And nothing worked. And the reason that poorly done compendiums on theology called Dietrich Bonhoeffer a radical is the notion that ultimately he encountered Hitler. So that for James Caan, encounter is the litmus test of truth. A couple of kind of ending thoughts, because what I want to do is I haven't done this, and I want to do it this morning. I want to give you some time to interact with questions or comments. James Caan ultimately realized that his understanding of black theology and black power were too limited. And interestingly enough, he realized that at the hand of a woman whose name was Dorothy Williams. Dorothy Williams was an African-American woman who, yes, was clearly concerned about the segregation and the racial treatment of blacks in America. However, that was also linked to her concern about the way women were treated in America. And so she challenged James Caan that he needed to be more mindful in terms of liberation concerning women. And then as the whole meaning of liberation in Central America began to emerge, he was challenged about the fact that liberation needed to be applied to Latinos. And so James Caan's concepts of liberation today are inclusive of just about every group that is out there. And he goes on to say that theology must always be inclusive. And what that means is that whenever we talk about any component of our faith, we need to be mindful of that wide circle out there that needs to envelop the countless expressions of human life. Number two, he is concerned about the white church. And he's concerned about the fact that the large denominations that are inhabited mostly by whites in our country today are failing. If you look, I don't know what your numbers are like in the Presbyterian home tradition, but I know in ours, they're terrible. We continue to lose way too many people. And James Caan suggests that perhaps one of the reasons that the church has failed to be truly dynamic in our time is that it has not addressed the issue of racism. Number three, he talks about revelation. And he says, you know, when we speak about revelation, so oftentimes what we talk about are these mystical experiences. And James Caan suggests that when we look into the life of or hear from the life of a black person, that's revelation. Currently, I am chairing our college's attempt to address the problems associated with sexual orientation. And that's very complex. It's not simple and it's not easy. I thought that I knew something about the issues related to sexual orientation. Until I sat around a table with some students, and I heard one young woman talk about the fact that after nearly 19 years of trying to be straight, she, you know, came out to her parents. She was asked to leave the home. And her comment that really revealed so much to me was this. She said, you know, when all of you, and she pointed to us around the table, she said, when all of you use the word break, you know, going home from school, you say, oh, it's almost break time. Not so for me, she said. I have nowhere to go. So you see that for me, that was a very revelatory experience. And that's what James Caan is calling people to be about and do. Realize that revelation, the Exodus, that the revelation concerning racism comes from personal encounters. Three, he talks about the fact that history is our friend. History is our friend. And he says there are two things. Number one, from history we can learn what we need to change. History is the classroom in which we realize the implications of the choices and decisions that we make. There was once a poem written by Roger Kipling. It was written back at the turn of the century, and it was entitled The White Man's Burden. And in that work, he talks about how it was that as England made of the subcontinent of India its possession and treated people of color there with less than respect, they created a burden for themselves that ultimately came to fruition, from which they had to extricate themselves. James Caan says, history teaches us the meaning of our choices and decisions. And secondly, history also gives us the opportunity to change them. He's a very optimistic guy. We, in fact, can make our cultures, our worlds, better than we have found them. And if we learn from the ancient lessons of history, that can happen. For example, he talks about Exodus. Think of all of the issues between the going down to Egypt by Moses and yesterday afternoon. Think of all the events across that era that could have been different if we would have learned the lesson that the Exodus teaches us. So history for him, is a learning process. It is also the opportunity to make changes. And lastly, he says that the racial question for the church today is not an option. It is a necessity. And as you look around the world today, more and more, have you noticed, there are more black faces, there are more brown faces. And I don't know whether how much you pay attention to this kind of thing, but we kind of have noticed this. In the advertising world on television, have you noticed the number of biracial couples? There's one where a grandpap is out playing hopscotch and he comes over and sits down. And I forget the product, but the point is that there he and his wife sit, Caucasian, with their granddaughter who's clearly biracial. And one of the phrases is, a lot has changed, and sometimes it can be hard. So the Caan's point is that if the church of today wants to become the church of tomorrow, the question of racism must be addressed. And for him, that addressment is not only directed toward white people, it's directed toward black people as well, reminding us all that in God's image and creation, we are important. I'm going to stop there because I'm thinking that maybe I've said some things that maybe you need to challenge and or question or comment upon or share something out of your own experience. So the floor is yours for the next 10 minutes. Anybody want to Yeah. Yes.
Someone wrote a nice article in the Post Gazette Saturday. The man from a different culture, I think, I forget.
Yeah.
But he was talking about the rule of law and said that in oppressive countries, the rule of law is a very scary thing. And when he comes into this country, he's afraid that it's also a very scary thing for some people. He's not black, but you know, I'm involved in the legal system, and I see black people coming into it. And there's a tremendous amount of anger because they feel that the law is racist and the legal system is racist. And it doesn't matter whether the judge is white or black, it's racist. And so I'm just throwing that out as just adding on to the bonfire here that you're building.
Sure, I do. I think that we delude ourselves into thinking. Well, I should say it first of all. I delude myself into thinking that I am devoid of racism. I was raised in a racist home. I was raised in a racist community. I was raised in a racist era. And I'm mindful that there are still parts of me that when I see a group of young black men when we're walking to the parking garage, triggers a different reaction than seeing a group of white young men. So that I think we have to acknowledge, and maybe some of you, you know, undoubtedly many of you have reached that nirvana state where you're good to go. And for that, thanks be to God. For lots of us, we need to deal with ourselves first. And then I think, secondly, what you're suggesting about the legal law court system. It appears to be the case that black persons tend to be more readily imprisoned for interestingly small crimes, for example, possession, than are white persons. Pardon me? That's right. That's a lot. That's a lot. So that it would appear that inherent in many of our institutions that ironically should be about the addressment of racial bias are themselves bias. I can't speak to your church because I don't know a lot about it. But I know in our denomination, we just, for example, a year ago last August, we elected a black female woman to be the bishop of this area. She has actually received letters saying, we don't want an N bishop. N's have no purpose here. And these are coming not from KKK people down in Alabama or white supremacists in Washington, D.C. No. They're coming from people who know she's been elected, and therefore you can assume that they are coming out of churches. If you think about that, it's unbelievably bizarre. We had a wonderful black bishop here for years, Roy Nichols. Great preacher, good guy, all the rest of it. When Roy came here, the Episcopal residence was located in Mount Lebanon. And it was suggested to him that he would be wise not to live there.
What year was that?
1968. Exactly. So, and I think we can find that just about everywhere and anywhere. I think it's scary to stereotype segregation or racism. I think you find it in all kinds of places. Yes, back there. Please. You guys work out who goes first.
Hey, Jack, a few of us are meeting to read a book on prison ministry. And one of the striking me that it is focused on
the black church ministering to re-entering citizens, predominantly black. And they hammer on that point over and over again. And I like the idea that there is no separation between black and white church, but the reality today is that there is, and they serve different audiences, and that the black church is uniquely qualified. Who's kind of the thesis of this book, to minister to black, particularly black returning prisoners and citizens. Is that feels like a conflict a little bit with what you were saying earlier?
I'm not at all. Well, I am somewhat aware of prison ministry. I'm also aware of the thesis of that book, and I'm not going to comment on whether I think it is right or wrong. What I'm going to offer is this: it's not my understanding of what we need to be working toward. I might be naive here, but my thinking is that hopefully we reach a point where a prisoner is not seen as a black prisoner, and a person who ministers to that person is not seen as a white or black person, but rather that they are two human beings, one of whom may have had some advantages that the second hasn't, and they're trying to help that person through that. And the thing that comes into my mind right now is that when I was at the Mars Church, and that was back in the 60s, late 60s, there was a fellow that was sort of the local domo of the church. In fact, when we went there for the interview, the take-in interview, after I met with the committee, they said, "We'd like you to go next door and meet Mr. Jordan." So I was a young guy, and sure, why not? So I go next door, and here's Mr. Jordan reclining on a couch because he was not feeling well. And we exchanged a few pleasantries, and then he said to me, "Before you go, young man, could you offer a prayer?" And I responded rather innocently and did, without realizing that when I finished, he gave me a grade in that he said, "I think you'll do just fine." Okay? Now, that man suffered a serious illness and had to be taken into Allegheny General Hospital. And for whatever reasons, I was a part of that. And we got him into a room, got him situated, and a black female nurse came in to take his vitals. And he refused. I think until we can break down that kind of racism that comes both ways, and I think I'd like to offer this too. And James Caan talks about this in his most recent book, Liberation. He says that, unfortunately, blacks are also racist. You know? It's an equal opportunity employer racism. Gives everybody a shot at it. So that I would like to think that we are moving, hopefully, toward a place and a time where we could do away with... isn't it great that we have a black doctor? Isn't it just good we have a doctor? There was another... does that make any sense to you back there? And I, you know, I'm kind of a... I'm kind of a rogue. And I think sometimes the church is its own worst enemy by advocating for those kinds of positions. It bothers me. But please, Ted.
So I've wondered over the last 10 years of our history or so, it seems to me that there's a dilemma that kind of shines out in dealing with the question. When you ignore it, it doesn't get better. When you call it out, it seems to get worse. In that there is a strong reaction when a situation, let's just think about when Henry Louis Gates was arrested for trying to enter his own house. When a president at the time spoke out forcefully about it, it evoked such a strong reaction that he had to back away from that just in order to keep from making the situation worse. Mm-hmm. And I have relatives, I have friends who will say racist things, and confronting that is not productive. It
actually reinforces or strengthens that reaction, and I see it in our public dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, you know, how do you deal with that reality?
Well, I have the answer to that question. Kahn speaks to that. And I suppose there are people that would call him a coward for saying this. But he maintains that when you confront racism, you have to do it with skill. And to call somebody out may not necessarily be a skillful response. He also talks about the fact that in the tradition of Jesus, and it's interesting to hear and read a guy like Kahn, because Kahn is perceived as almost being a sociologist. So that whenever you hear him using theological language, it's like, whoa, where'd that come from? He says that in the spirit of Jesus, we need to witness to our position as over and against, somehow defend it. And I do think there's some value in that. I don't know how you operate, but when somebody gets in my face about something, I tend to say, wait a minute, back off. So I think that there's a time whenever confrontation may be absolutely necessary, unfortunately. But I think there ought to be some intermediary steps before you get there. One of the things I've learned from students is this. Boy, I'll tell you, there's a huge compendium out there in terms of positions. And when you begin to try to understand all those varying traditions, you have to begin to understand where these kids come from and what they've been taught and who's taught them what they think. So to call a kid out as a racist is not a good idea. The more important thing is, because what you're doing is you're challenging everything he knows. His mom, his dad, his family, his grandpap. I had a young man in my office the other day who said that he was really anxious about Thanksgiving because the previous week he had been home and his uncle and this young man's brother got into one of those awful political arguments that had uncle getting up from the table, uttering a couple of ugly phrases, and walking out. That's not going to help anything. I know it's an overworked word, but I like the idea of dialogue. And I really like the idea of witnessing to your convictions. But every now and then, I'm also enough of a Bonhoeffer student to realize every now and then you have to say, that's wrong, and pay whatever price is associated with it. Best I can do on that, please.
Are we making any progress?
Boy, I wish I knew the answer to that one. The way I'd answer that is this. I think that we thought we had by electing a black president. But I'm not so sure that meant anything relevant to race relations in America. Because it would appear that race relations in America right now are very tense.
I think that all these things that we've experienced in our lifetime are a continuum of two steps forward, one step back. Step forward, one step back. And having that black president was two steps forward, now we're one step back.
Right.
But next go around, and there will be another time, and hopefully it'll be a woman next time, as a president, it becomes not part of the conversation. It just is. And so I'm an optimist.
Yeah.
But going back to historically, I worry about ever overcoming what we could have done after World War II when we redlined districts which helped segregate churches. And loans weren't given that should have been given to the returning GIs that were black. I don't know if we're ever going to ever overcome that. And that worries me more than...
You need to read Cory Booker. He's the United States Senator from New Jersey. You need to read his book where he talks about his parents His parents were both PhDs. They were both vice presidents of IBM. And they were assigned to the New York office of IBM. It took them 3 years to be able to purchase a home. Because every time they would get to the physical encounter, "Oh, I'm so sorry, but this just came off the market," kind of thing. So he talks about the redlining that you're referring, and that was back in the 50s era. However, he goes on to talk about the fact that there he is now, a United States senator, a graduate of Stanford, an Oxford scholar. So I think you hit an important idea. It's not one continuous step forward from darkness to light. It's those measured steps, both forward and backward. Hopefully more forward than backward, that we need to work with. Now, and I do think, though, that the questions of economics and politics are very essential to resolving some of these questions. I mean, if you think about if the statistics at all can be believed, the black community is nowhere near the white community, speaking in terms of averages relevant to income. That's still a problem. Of course, as I'll try to say next time, it's also a problem for women today. I guess, Ted, coming back to your idea, until and unless people with great power who perpetrate that kind of injustice are confronted, it may continue on. And don't you think we're seeing that to some degree? I mean, we're more and more people who are powerful people are being called out. And that's very painful. And if you notice, they've been called out, but nothing's been resolved, has it? We're still playing around with that stuff. That's what I say when I think it's very complex. But I think that if you take the salient ideas of James Kahn, empathy, and if you can root an understanding of racism in your Christian faith, I believe that those are terribly powerful components to moving forward. I really do. There's something about the nature of Christianity in its best sense as you look at the meaning of God, for example. Karl Barth says this in one of his works. He says, "Does it ever occur to you that there's an enormous lesson in the often taken for granted idea that God's word was revealed in and through a Jew, not a Greek and not a Roman, but through a Jew?" And he goes on to talk about how it is that the revelation of God in Jesus as a Jew has an enormous lesson in terms of how we relate to each other in terms of minority and injustice. It's a thought. Anybody else want to do the closing comment, please?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, let's go, then we'll have you do it last. Go ahead.
I think I'm optimistic too, because I think the demographics of our country are changing. And whether we like it or not, our children are interacting with one another in settings where they will have common experiences. Unfortunately, the church is lagging way behind in terms of this happening. But in public schools, in colleges, in their social organizations, I don't think our children and our grandchildren see race the way our generation did. I don't think they see it as a problem. What they need to see and what they're trying to understand is how different their cultures are, one from the other. And the church has got to understand that too in terms of worship. If we're ever going to have worship experiences, we have to recognize the cultural difference of the people that sit in the pews. And that's not going to be easy, I don't think.
The one problem, and I think that I agree with that, I mean, but I still encounter students who operate out of a racial bias, because that's what they've been taught.
That's right.
And the good news on that is that most of those people can be changed. You can influence a mind with a positive, genuine notion. However, I think we need to make sure that whenever it is not possible to change that mind, that that mind is dealt with. You know, and I realize I'm operating out of a very small network, but one of the things I'm learning is this. Sure, there are lots of people out there that are homophobic. And while you might try to interact with that, you don't necessarily change that. And you have to kind of accept that difference. However, whenever that homophobic behavior is such that it intimidates a young person in the dormitory, that needs to be challenged. You can't remain silent on that kind of thing. And we're living in a time of change. There's no question about that. But we have to be helpful to that change. I'm sorry. You're...
I agree with you completely. What was common in my dad's age group?
Excuse me.
Now, vice versa, grandchildren now are marrying biracial and having families. Everybody's very comfortable with it. But I think in order for the different races to be mixing and mingling and getting to know one another, that's an economic jump. People in poverty have no chance to intermingle. The segregation is kind of like not just racial, but poverty now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. There's no question. There's no question. Maybe we could leave it here. There's no question about the reality of the challenge. It's still there. The good news is that there may be more people, more voices, who are supporting a more positive result of the change. Well, we got that solved, right? I mean, somebody take notes and mail it in, yeah? And I'll see you next time for Queen's Issues.